Hi, this is Alan Shartok in conversation today with infectious disease Dr. John Bennett Robbins, MD. Dr. Robbins' research has focused on developing vaccines for diseases prevalent in infants and children. He and a colleague, Rachel Schneerson, MD, developed a vaccine designed to eradicate bacterial meningitis caused by a very dangerous type of influenza type B, a deadly and debilitating infectious agent and the leading cause of acquired mental retardation in children. The vaccine is now used throughout the world. His vaccine development research also has targeted typhoid, pertussis, and other diseases. Born in Brooklyn, New York in 1932, Dr. Robbins received his AB from New York University in 1955, his MD with AOA honors from NYU College of Medicine. He received his clinical training at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard University from 1959 to 1961, graduate training in infectious disease and immunology, University of Florida from 1961 to 64. He was awarded a fellowship in immunochemistry, Weizmann Institute of Science in 1965, followed by an appointment as Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Immunology, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, New York City, from 1967 to 1970. In 1970, he was appointed as the Clinical Director and Chief of the Laboratory of Developmental and Molecular Immunity, National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Later, Dr. Robbins was made the Director of the Division of Bacterial Products at the FDA and then Co-Director of the Laboratory of Developmental and Molecular Immunity, National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. He retired in 2012. Dr. Robbins received the Mead Johnson Award in 1975, University of Gothenburg, Sweden, the Maxwell Finland Award of the Infectious Disease Society of America, Albert Sabin Gold Medal Award in 2004, Albert and Mary Lasker Award in Clinical Medicine and Science in 1996, Pasteur Award for Recent Contributions in Vaccine Development, Children's Vaccine Initiative, the HHS Secretary's Award for Distinguished Research Service for the Development of Vaccines for Typhoid Fever, and later for Staphylococcus aureus. Dr. Robbins was elected to the National Institute of Medicine in 1992, National Academy of Sciences in 1996, and received the Distinguished Scholar Award, People's Republic of China, in 2009. Welcome, my old friend, John Robbins. I should start us out by saying that the Robbins and the Shartoks have been friends for many, many years, and we have always been impressed that we were living next to a living legend in the area of vaccines. And John, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's nice to see you again, and congratulations.
Well, thank you. With a resume like that, you're congratulating me on having a grandchild.
That's very important, buddy.
That's incredible. Okay, so John, because I know a lot about your family, take us back to its beginnings with Papa, Harry Robbins, our longtime neighbor in Alford, Massachusetts, and what he taught you and how you got to go to medical school.
Well, I always wanted to be a doctor, because my uncle, Harry's brother, was my hero. And I never did anything other than prepare for entering medical school, although in school I became a history major because I enjoyed reading about it so much. I went to medical school, and in medical school I was very fortunate to meet very, very educated, teacher-devoted people who helped me. In fact, they are the ones that directed me to the University of Florida, which turned out to be an important step in my life.
But medical school was at
New York University.
At NYU.
Bellevue. Mm-hmm. And after my training at the University of Florida, I got a position at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And then...
Now, Albert Einstein at the time, as I remember my New York politics, was also a place which had a certain free-thinking, left-of-center docs, did it not?
That's probably true. I really didn't know them. I was a student. I came home and worked. And then I said hello to my wife, ate supper, went back to work. Mm-hmm. I really didn't know. There were really a dazzling group of very brilliant people. And I enjoyed my stay there. It was one of the happiest times of my life. After school, I met a genius. His name was John Sieber. Poor John died only recently, but he said one day, why don't you go to the Weizmann Institute of Israel? They do something that you might be interested in. Besides, you might enjoy looking at this part of your life. So he went there, and that changed my life.
How long were you there? And what did you learn at the Weizmann Institute? Now, Weizmann himself was a scientist. after whom it was named, of course, the first president, right?
That's right. And you know why he got the Balfour Declaration? He taught the English how to make smokeless explosive power after they lost the Battle of Jutland in World War One.
Wow. Okay, so now you're at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. You're Jewish. Did any of your own upbringing now get solidified, or did anything about being in Israel affect you?
Many, many things. We still have friends from our days in Israel. But scientifically, I learned polymer chemistry from some of the very best.
And what is polymer chemistry?
The chemistry of making polymers of simple substances, like proteins, like polysaccharides. And when I was there, I thought, what could I do when I went back to put all this experience and information to use? And when I went on to the wards at the University of Florida, the first thing I saw were three cases of Haemophilus influenza type B meningitis.
And what was that?
Meningitis is a disease caused by a bacteria that enters the spinal fluid and causes inflammation.
How serious a problem was it in this country?
I calculate that it wasn't very much different than paralytic polio. I would say offhand, about one in every 250 babies got Haemophilus meningitis.
Well,
there were some rather well-known people. There was a football player who had it.
But babies.
It's usually a disease of infants and young children. And then they get immune. And it does occur in older children and adults, but it's a rare phenomenon. If it does occur in adults, it's usually in an adult with injured immune system.
And how do they get immune?
That's a very interesting topic that I've been always followed through by reading. Most of the immunity we get is from related but not identical bacteria. And so this structure that induces immunity, it's called a capsule polysaccharide, is shared in nature. And if you live long enough, you'll come in contact with it and become immune. That's why when we inject the children with Haemophilus type B conjugated vaccine, they become immune to life because they keep on getting stimulated by non-pathogenic, cross-reacting, harmless bacteria.
So jumping ahead a little bit, John, and I'm coming back to your development of this. Is this a major problem now as it was then?
Not at all. It's hardly ever seen. They don't even teach it in medical school sometimes.
Really?
Yes.
Really, because I have seen times at summer camps and places where a kid complains of an earache and everybody starts jumping through hoops thinking that this may be meningitis.
Well, it's one of the causes of meningitis to have an infection in the middle ear that breaks through into the spinal fluid of the brain. But that does not occur anymore.
Interesting. John, is it ever infectious? In other words, is meningitis infectious from one person to another?
Under unusual circumstances, but it certainly is. We had it in daycare centers. We had young children crowded together, and many of them were non-immune and did catch it. So it can be contagious, but under unusual circumstances.
So let's go back to your time. How old were you? You get back from Israel. How old are you then?
40, I guess, 45.
About 45. So you're still a relatively young man.
How old do you think I am?
Now? Well, I think you're 10 years older than I am. So therefore, I have a pretty good idea. Okay. Now, so tell us about your journey. I mean, how was it you got interested in curing this problem?
When I saw these cases and realized that this was an understandable disease based upon the polymer chemistry I had learned.
In Israel.
In Israel, I started to read. And that's been, I think, my fort. I'm a good reader, and I have a good memory. And so I read and read and read, and I suddenly realized we could make a vaccine out of this.
How much experience had you had in vaccines when you suddenly realized it, in your own words?
None.
So explain it.
It was just interesting. I thought it was a good problem. Everyone around me, my supervisors, thought it was a good problem. And so I started to work on it.
And did you have to convince the supervisors? Did you have to?
Oh, no, never.
Really?
Oh, no. I always had really remarkable people as seniors. In fact, unfortunately, my first professor just died recently, Dick Smith in Florida. But he never said anything to me except to encourage me.
Go to it.
Exactly.
Okay, so tell us about, I mean, we think about Madame Curie, we think about this and that, all the things that people, when they had that aha moment, take us on the journey with you.
I never thought about it, tell you the truth. I was always so busy from day to day, I never thought very much about the future. But one thing I did learn, that when you learn one thing well, you know almost everything. And right now...
What do you mean by that?
I'm fairly confident. I think I'm confident in the fact that we have devised and have published mostly vaccines for tuberculosis and malaria based upon our studies of Haemophilus influenza.
But these are not yet back.
These are at a research level.
Yes. But let's go back to what you said. Based on your earlier success, you think that that provided the roadmap for tuberculosis vaccine.
Exactly.
Okay. So tell us about your work with Schneerson. How did that come about?
Well, Dr. Schneerson and I had a mutual friend. It was a woman that became a very important figure in Israeli medicine. Her name was Bracha Ramot, a very unusual person. In World War II, she was a line lieutenant in the Russian army. You know what kind of...
Yeah.
that took. And she was just a wonderful person and a wonderful clinical doctor. And Rachel Schneerson did a internship and residency at Tel HaShomer Hospital when she went to the director of the hospital.
And that's in Israel?
That's in Israel. And I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He was very famous. He discovered the genetics of human disease. I'll think of his name. But they said, why don't you go to Dr. Robin's lab? He's young. He has some good ideas. And you might find a place here. And that's all there was to it.
So they went to your lab. I'm sorry, John, following this along.
Yes.
In Israel or in Florida?
The Bronx, Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
Okay. I'm somehow missing this connection. So when did you get to Einstein?
Well, we were in Israel for a year.
Yes.
And poor Joan had very little help.
That's your wife, your wonderful wife, Joan.
Four children and not even a washing machine. Had to do all the wash by hand.
Yeah.
And when she got back to Florida, I guess she was discontent because in Israel you were in the center of an intellectual ferment almost at every level. When I was at the Weizmann Institute, because I was an MD, all the PhDs used to come to me and say, is this useful? What should we do about this? I was surrounded by people asking me unanswerable questions. And so when we came back, I was not satisfied with the University of Florida, although we still have good friends there, really good friends. So we went to Einstein.
What was that? You get on a bus and go to Einstein? I mean, you have to negotiate.
Well, I made an application, but they took me just... with the application.
Okay.
They just accepted me.
And they realized that you had the potential to bring them something that they didn't have.
Exactly.
Okay. Was there government money yet? Did you have government money to fund any
of
this?
No, I had Einstein money, which they had very little of, but I worked next to the city hospitals, so I would go to the laboratories, and the people who worked there were very nice to me. They gave me anything I wanted anytime I asked. It wasn't very much, but I didn't need too much money. When I got to the NIH, then I had unlimited supply and a director who understood the potential of what we're doing. So I've never had any trouble with money until recently.
Okay, so now let's go back. You're at Einstein, and how does that go?
More than wonderful. We had a stream of very bright people, really very bright people, and supportive and helpful. There was a very famous scientist there named Harry Eagle, who also put his 2 cents in, Irv London. My friend Matthew Scharf, who's now a very senior person there too, was very helpful. Everywhere I went, I always had people that encouraged me and, what's most important, asked me unanswerable questions.
Like?
Anything. Why do we do this? How much is that? Why do you measure this? And if you listen to them carefully and you study, you learn a lot.
And how many people did you need working for you when you went to Einstein, for example, or at Florida?
Well, at Einstein, we had, I think, 3 or 4 people, lab technicians and Dr. Schneerson. And then when I got to the NIH...
And how did that happen? Let's take you
these
from...
These are people who applied, and I asked for money, and they gave it to me.
But how did you go from Einstein to NIH? That's a big move for you.
I was asked.
Who asked you?
The scientific director of the Child Health Institute asked me.
Yeah, and you said, okay.
Couldn't turn it down.
Because?
Well, he made me the clinical director of the Child Health Institute, and I was there for about 10 minutes when I realized that was not for me. I was a research doctor, and he let me go back in the laboratory.
Yeah.
I told you, I've always been surrounded by helpful people.
Well, because you were bringing them something that
extraordinary. I always hope so.
Extraordinary. Okay, so now let's get back to what you were doing and what you learned. At what point did you succeed in this vaccine for children's meningitis?
Well, we first made the polysaccharide, and we did a study with that. And
okay,
showed...
let's go back on that. I'm sorry, John. Yes. What is a polysaccharide one more time?
Polysaccharide is a polymer of sugars. Saccharide means sugar, and poly means a polymer. And that polymer was the capsule of the bacteria, which is a supracellular structure that protects the bacteria against the actions of serum complement, and so therefore the bacteria is not harmed by any immune function.
Good
so we made the polysaccharide, and the polysaccharide was safe. It stimulated antibodies in adults and older children. And the
how did you test for it? Did you test in animals?
We used animals, but I don't believe in animal research.
Okay.
If you're going to make a vaccine for humans, you have to study it in humans.
Okay.
Who is it? Pope said the proper study of mankind is man.
So you develop what you think is the right vaccine. And how do you start to test it?
Well, there are tests to show if it has inflammatory properties, such as causing fever. So it has to be prepared so it doesn't cause fever.
And how do you establish that it doesn't cause fever? If you
there are many tests to do that. One of the more recent ones that you know about is the test that they use for Mimulus that measures the property of bacteria called endotoxin that causes fever. So by doing chemistry, measuring what you have, and then looking at its biological effects, you can get something that's almost pure, and that doesn't cause any serious adverse reactions.
Do you remember the day that you think you came up with the final product?
I do remember the day when I injected myself.
Really? Is that what you did first?
And I went into my friend's, Matty Schroff, sat down. I almost fainted. I said, God, Matty, I have little babies at home. Guess what I just did?
And did your colleagues know you were going to do that?
No, that was a secret.
It was a secret because you thought they'd say no?
No, because I was a little afraid, I guess. I'm not sure. I wasn't sure of myself. And, of course, now I've supervised giving vaccines to tens of thousands of infants.
Sure.
No reactions.
No reactions. Ever?
Ever.
It's amazing. Okay, so that day you go and you inject yourself. You go home to Joan and you say, I think we got it.
No. I just let things play out. You apply to the FDA. In fact, when I applied to the FDA...
That's the Food and Drug Administration, yeah.
Excuse me, that's right. When I applied to the FDA, I went to the woman who discovered the bacteria that I had been working with. Her name was Margaret Pittman, and she discovered the Haemophilus influenza as the cause of meningitis. And we sat down, and we said, what do we do? And she spent about 2 or 3 hours telling what we should do. We just followed it.
Could be a little bit more specific, if you would.
How to prepare it, how to test for it, how to make an informed consent form, how to notify the parents of what you propose to do. It's interesting that all the parents we ever asked to try this new vaccine in infants said yes.
Tell us a little about that, because as you know, what you've just said has tremendous reverberations as we come up into the last, you know, several years in which there are whole communities of people who don't want to have their kids immunized for anything.
I know. It's unbelievable how the population been led around by these fakes. You know, at least one of them has confessed that he made it up. The autism business turned out to be fake.
You mean that people got autism because they were immunized?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were asking these parents, and the parents were saying, okay, go ahead and do it. And how did you convince them? I mean, why?
Well, we wrote a piece of paper for them. It took us days, I mean all day, to write it clearly, explicitly, without hiding anything. And we just never had anyone say no.
So if you've done nothing else in your life, and you, of course, have done much else in your life, the fact that this children's meningitis immunization is on the books is because of you.
Well, we worked with another group, but we were first by far. And we taught them how to make the final product, which actually the person who did it is a good friend.
That's interesting because Scientifically, I'm always impressed by the fact that people are willing to work with each other as opposed to, I want to get there before they do and I'm not going to help them.
No, I never felt that way. All you'd have to do is go onto a ward and see a child with meningitis with an arched back who couldn't speak afterwards or who's deaf to know what you were doing was of value.
Is that what happens with meningitis? A child can become deaf?
About one 1/10 of all the children that get the disease and are treated, have brain injury. It's a terrible disease. Terrible disease.
Okay, so you now start to do these tests. When did you know you had it?
When we looked at the first data from the adults that were immunized with the first vaccine, and we saw that the antibodies in the adult that we had induced with the vaccine had all the properties that we associate with protection, then we knew we were on the right track.
This is an incredible contribution that you've made. Here you all are, you know, still a fairly young man, but you know, it must.
Alan, I'm a great grandfather.
but it must be really something to know that on your watch you created this thing that has helped so many people.
I tell you, I never think of it. I'm so interested in what we're doing. And it's so difficult to get something like that to be done. See, I was very lucky when I was doing this. The fellow who was the director of research at Merck was a man named Maurice Hilleman, and he understood immediately what went on. In fact, he backed us with everything.
I want to talk to you about this because it's fascinating to me, the relationship between pharma, big pharma, and the research, the basic research that is done.
I think you've touched on a very important point. One of the big problems now is that companies are directing vaccine policy. Mistake. The intention of a company is to make money. The intention of research scientists is to make a vaccine. And now, very often, they don't go together.
Explain that a little bit. In other words, what's the potential conflict of interest?
Well, I'm not sure it's a conflict of interests. I think it's a matter of low IQ.
Low IQ on the part of both sides or one side?
The manufacturers, but that's okay. They can take it. Let me give you a for instance.
Sure.
We have invented, I'm sure, a brand new vaccine for pertussis.
Right.
You've heard about outbreaks all over the country. We have something new, and we've written it, and the article has been accepted and published. And in the article, they point out that there are two or maybe three components of the current vaccine that shouldn't be there. There was no scientific basis for them putting it in, just the historic background of the disease, which itself is very.
And what is pertussis again?
Whooping cough.
Yeah, okay.
Pertussis, severe coughing.
So all of us, right, have been in for years, have gotten this injection.
Alan, that's a very interesting and important question. The vaccines that we inject now are composed of proteins. Proteins have a very specific structure. And when you immunize with them, after the vaccine disappears from the site of injection, the antibodies go slowly down, so the immunity is not lifelong. Now, with Haemophilus influenza type B, the vaccine of importance is a polysaccharide whose structure is widely shared in nature, so we keep on making antibodies to it. So that's lifelong, but a protein is not. And the problem we're having with pertussis is that the immunity doesn't last forever, and it reappears again. There are many other reasons for it, but those are the major ones.
So the parents who have been objecting to giving their kids pertussis, immunization, would, if the kid eventually gets it because it's not lifelong, they say, aha, you see, you guys were frauds all along.
I don't think that's occurred. I think the media have been educated to the fact that it's not lifelong. They don't understand the reason why a polysaccharide should be. I think they understand that, and I think we've solved the problem.
Okay, now this is great. So if you've solved the problem, how come it isn't being administered?
Well, the article was only published 2 months ago.
I see.
Although I've talked about it. I did go up to Harvard to speak to the Department of Microbiology, and this is a radical new thing, and I was waiting for terrible comments and degrading statements. No one said a word. I think it's obvious. I think the thing is going to work. It's cheap. It's safe. And I think it's going to change.
Who will make the money?
I can tell you who will not.
You will not. Because basically, one of the things that's always been quite clear to me is that the basic research is done often by the government, NIH, but that the money is made, so it was a question I think I understood, by Big Pharma.
That's okay. I mean, if they make it and the product is good and it's affordable, there's no reason why that shouldn't occur. The problem is that they're making judgmental decisions about what to make. And there they're not competent, or at least the influence of business, the business people on the scientific staff, is much too pervasive.
Okay, so Dr. John Robbins, develop that one for us, because it's so interesting.
Well, years ago, I was invited to Merck by this president named Maurice Hellermann, and I gave a long talk about how to make a pertussis vaccine safer. It was a good talk. I worked very hard on it. The audience enjoyed it. About a month or two later, Maurice Hellermann calls me up and says, the business people say, we're not going to make it. We can't make a good profit out of it. That's very common.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately,
was he right?
All the companies that make vaccine make big money.
Mm-hmm.
Big money. You know why? You have to take it by law.
Everybody has to take it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that'll change. It probably should. I don't know how it will. Our current travail of working with the companies is such we have not been able to convince their business people at all. And it's very hard to talk.
And what do they say? They can't say, well, we're not doing this because we're greedy. They have to give you a rational answer, don't
Never
they?
Never have. Just say it. We don't think it's opportune for the company to make. And I've talked to them all.
And they just won't tell you.
Yeah. But there are some breakthroughs. It looks like our typhoid vaccine is going to be made by...
So it also comes out of the original model on meningitis. So now you have a typhoid, a pertussis, and another, right? Another major one.
Pneumococcal vaccine.
Okay.
Made exactly by the same thinking. Exactly the same.
But every once in a while on the old movie channel, the Madame Curie story comes up or one of these places, and I watch them.
Do you know about Madame Curie? Let me tell you. She's one of the few people that ever won two Nobel Prizes.
Yeah.
But the only one that ever won two Nobel Prizes in one field.
Ah, I stayed across the street from where she's entombed. And I guess the question is, how do you make sense of a system that won't do what's right?
I don't think I'm qualified to say that. First of all, I don't know too much how government works, really. And second of all, I have a very short temper.
I've never seen it. And I've known you for a long, long time.
Oh, you're a lovely person. Why should I have Even though we used to argue politics.
Well, yeah, only because you had a friend who drove me crazy.
I miss him, by the way.
He's gone?
Yeah.
And that's why I asked you the Einstein left to center question. But one could argue... But if you see so obviously that you had this incredible success with the meningitis vaccine, and you've been honored all over the world many times for all of this, and now you say, okay, building on that, we're going to solve the lifelong issue of pertussis protection going away. We're going to do all these other things, and they won't do it.
You know what? I think ultimately you will. I think there are enough people around who can see through this problem. Each of these vaccines has a special problem. One of the biggest problems that we would have to face is with tuberculosis, and that's because very few people understand the disease.
Well, tell us a little bit.
Tuberculosis is a encapsulated organism just like pneumococcus.
Talk about this encapsulation and what it means.
Well, of course, it must be a Darwinian thing. The encapsulated bacteria are the ones that survive. The ones that are not encapsulated or have a non-functional capsule don't survive.
But what do you mean by the word capsule in this case?
It's actually a polymer of a polysaccharide surrounding the bacteria. And when you see a picture of it, it's quite dramatic.
Okay, back to TB.
Well, TB has been, I think, misunderstood for years. I think most people still don't understand it. The man who started it all was one of the great scientists of our time. His name was Landsteiner. Landsteiner worked at the Rockefeller University Institute. He discovered poliovirus, discovered the Rh factor, and also discovered the concept of...
The Rh factor, which leads to blue babies, is that right?
Exactly.
Yes. Okay. And he did the basic research before Salk and Sabin and the rest of those guys.
Well, Salk and Sabin's contribution was to make a vaccine. Remember, they only had a virus. The CCNY is going to have a Salk Appreciation Day, and I'm on the program to speak. It's a very interesting story. By the way, there's a wonderful book called Polio. It's not a good book. It's a wonderful book. Accurate, complete, and the two characters, Sabin did all the lab work himself. Everything. We have his notes. Injected the monkeys, did the antibodies, cleaned up the cages. And Sabin was a vicious person to deal with in public if you disagreed with him. I think the only person that he ever got along with him is me, because I used to liken him to God.
And how about Salk?
Salk never did anything. He organized people. In fact, the fellow who did most of it is still around. Julie Younger at Pittsburgh was there. That's where he did his work, in Pittsburgh. And I went to the Salk presentation, too. So I learned about the subject, and I learned it from the people who actually did the work.
So of the two of them, who was the more important?
Both.
Really?
Yeah. Because Sabin's vaccine is still used mostly around the world because it's relatively cheap and easy to administer. But the Salk vaccine is a better vaccine. Lasts better and it's safer. You don't get accidental polio from Sabin strain that occasionally occurs.
Well, it's so interesting that in the beginning, you know, Salk got most of the public credit.
Sure.
But as time has gone on, you hear Sabin more and more.
And they both made major contributions, really major contributions. And each in his own way, they're both different characters.
Does it drive you crazy, John Robbins, with your background in immunology and all the rest, when you read about some country which politically decides we're not going to administer this polio vaccine?
You saw what happened in Pakistan. You have these crazies called the Taliban, you know, who stop immunization. Now, what are they going to do? They have a war. They're having refugees. Well, we're going to spread polio with these poor people who have never been immunized.
So the upshot is that a lot of people are going to get polio.
Well, we're having outbreaks of polio, even in this country.
Because parents decide they don't want to immunize their kids.
Exactly.
Does that make you nuts?
A lot of things make me nuts. Look at the news. Can you go nuts from the news? Where isn't there a war?
Yeah, no, but that brings you into politics. So you're saying because politics exists, that's why we're not doing the proper immunization.
My daughter lives in a place, Boulder, Colorado. About 10 to 20% of the children in Boulder, Colorado are not immunized because their parents think it's dangerous that we're doing something nature didn't intend. And guess what? They have a lot of pertussis.
Does pertussis kill?
Occasionally when it does, it's terrible. The kids choke to death. It's a coughing disease, and I don't know if you've ever heard a record of a child with pertussis coughing, but it's paroxysmal, and it doesn't stop for 2 or 3 minutes. Now, you try and cough as hard as you can for 2 or 3 minutes. You see what happens, and if they've been eating at the end, because they can't breathe anymore, they go, that's the whoop, and they inhale food and other junk into their lung, and that's what kills them. Coughing is the key.
So here you are. You're in, you know, a mature stage of your life. You see that you have something that would make these vaccines more efficient if we change them. And it doesn't happen.
We had people come over the house, very distinguished couple. Her name is Ann Gershon, and she's the person who prompted and followed up the use of chickenpox vaccine and the shingles vaccine. It's her accomplishment. She lives in Copake. The other person who was there was Michael Gershon, who I know from high school, who had pertussis and coughed almost for a year. It's a very unpleasant disease. Blew out a little part of his lung. So even in adult life, it's unpleasant and causes lots of mischief. But in infants, it's devastating.
So do you have a community of immunologists? In other words, do you know everybody in the field? Does everybody know you? I mean, you know, here are the Gershons, you're talking about them and their contribution. I know that antique dealers tend to hang out together. Do immunologists do the same thing?
I used to when I was at the NIH course, so I could go to symposium, but not being facetious, but really what I'm saying, I've outgrown that now. Mm-hmm. I know what the problems are. I read almost everything. So I don't learn anything anymore by going to a symposium.
Now, John Robbins, tell us a little bit about these awards that you've won. The prestigious Albert Lasker Award for Clinical Medicine Research. How did that come about?
One day, a very famous guy at the NIH saw me, ran over to me. His name was Tony Fauci. You've seen on television all the time. He gave me a big hug, and he said, John, you got the Lasker Award.
Did you even know that you had been nominated?
No.
Really?
Sure.
And he just came and said, you got the Lasker Award. Yes. So who put you in for something like that?
The Vegas idea.
Really? Do you remember when you got the award?
Yeah, sure. It was a lot of fun.
Where was it?
We went in New York and we got up, made a little speech at a lovely dinner. I wasn't allowed to talk because my colleague got up and said, we've been here a long time and all John will do is tell you some bad jokes and I'll tell you what we know.
You are a bad joke teller, right?
Oh, the best.
Everybody knows that. And a punster of the first order.
That's fun. Yeah. I like words.
Yeah. Okay, so you get the Lasker Award. Does getting an award like that, besides the gratification, you know, you're being told you did great work, does it lead to better things for you?
I never used any of those awards as a method for getting what I wanted, ever.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter what you do.
I can't tell you about that.
Well, but you must perceive whether or not you get greater respect after you win a major award like that.
Maybe I did, maybe I don't. I just don't know. When I talk, I spend so much time preparing for it. It's such hard work that I get up, give my talk, answer some questions, and sit down. I really don't know what else is going around. And I've never heard anyone get up and introduce me like that. I guess they know I would like to stay sort of quiet.
Hmm. Okay, so what about the others? The gold medal from Sabin.
I don't know.
How did you get that?
I don't know. I don't even remember. We did have a very happy time. I was awarded a Scholar's Award in China.
Yeah.
Because I taught most of them how to make these new vaccines. And that was really a terrific time. We had a wonderful time there.
Did the Chinese, your politics have always been slightly left of center. Did the Chinese recognize that when you were there?
No, I had no political interaction at all. We just talked with the scientists and especially the kids in the lab. I think each time I visited, we'd spend maybe a whole day, 8 or 9 hours, answering questions. What do you do this? How much is that? What do you look for in this? That's what I know.
Well, no, that's fascinating because here the United States has always been, especially years ago, competitive with China. You go over there as a scientist and you give them everything you got, right?
So children, that's first. Politics is second.
In your career, has politics ever entered into it? You know, now, be straight with us. At NIH and, you know, there were the McCarthy years, there was the rest of the stuff.
Politics do occur at the NIH among the personnel and among the institutes. And in fact, the reason that my associate and I retired is that we were urged to retire by the new administration. And I don't want to talk too much about that.
Was that the Bush administration or the Obama administration?
No, that's the NIH administration.
Oh, the new NIH.
New directors, yes.
Do you have any sense of why?
Yes. Personal, not personal against me. The people who became in charge wanted to have their research done, and they felt that I was competing with them because our research was there, so they urged us to retire.
That's disgusting.
I think a little lower.
A little lower than disgusting. Yes. Disgusting minus. Does that dirty laundry ever get publicized?
I hope not. I think the NIH's reputation is such that it should be above that petty politics, but sometimes it's not.
Is it this well-known phenomena where somebody new comes in and they say, well, I don't get the same credit for what somebody else did or has been doing as if it's on my watch and it's something new?
A little, not exactly that. I think people who do that don't have a big idea of what they're involved with. I mean, you're dealing with the health research institute of the world, and you must never do anything that isn't in the best scientific and the best humane vein ever without any.
Personally, your father had a remarkable business. He was the off-size paper box king of the country. So if a major department store needed a box for a product, they would have to go to him because he...
I want to tell you something about my father. I only learned in my adult life from reliable sources. My father pitched against Satchel Paige.
Really?
Yes.
He was a big man, I'll tell you that much. I loved Harry. And you had two brothers, one of whom was a doctor who passed now, and the other who took over the business.
Yes.
And then you had, as you say, you're a great-grandfather now. How has all of that familial stuff played out in your life? In other words, as a scientist, I guess I'm trying to decide, what have you passed on, and would you want your kids to do what you did, or their kids? How do you see all of this?
I've never tried to interfere with my grandchildren's or children's lives. Maybe with David, I pushed him to be a doctor. My youngest is a doctor, a terrific doctor, not a good doctor, a terrific doctor. And their children are just wonderful. I haven't convinced any of them to become a doctor or a scientist.
What has the practice of medicine become to you? I mean, in other words, is it this country, you know, I'm between sixes and sevens on this. I have to say that I'm not sure I like where it's all going, and I'm wondering what you see.
I agree with you. It's become impersonal. There are now more people in medicine than practice medicine. In other words, there are more people collecting money, giving orders, making money than there are doctors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's way out of line. And it's true the practice of medicine is changing because what they're doing now wasn't even visualized when I was a young kid. Can you imagine doing neurology and looking what you're seeing? That is, you can see the brain work. So the practice of medicine has gotten better. It's gotten more efficient. But the business of medicine sure as hell hasn't kept up with it.
What's the better way?
Well, if I tell you what I think, we may have the army after me. I think medicine should be free. I think if it's done properly, we wouldn't have all the people that we have making money off it.
Is that why it's so bad? Because people are making money off of it?
Yes, of course. It's not a profit industry. It's not for profit. We don't hire an army to make profit. We make an army to defend ourselves. We need doctors to keep us healthy.
You spent and have spent time in Israel. What's that like?
We had a wonderful doctor who was available all the time.
And what's the healthcare system look like there?
I can't tell you. I really don't know about it. I do know that they have terrific health statistics. And my interaction with Israeli doctors is they were very well trained, very well trained. So I can't tell you much more than that.
So if you look around the world and see a system, what catches your eye?
Sweden, Norway, Denmark, they don't charge. You're sick, you go to a doctor, they take care of you.
And you pay a lot of taxes.
Well, we're getting there.
Right.
Well, but that's a good way of doing it. You never have to worry about spending money. And so you go to a doctor when you need to.
So you're a bright guy. And you have looked at the way things work. Give us a précis real quickly about why it is in this country that we can't seem to get to that place.
You know, I'm going to talk a little politics, which I shouldn't. We had the leader of the Senate saying that the only thing that he wanted to do when he was in the Senate is get rid of Barack Obama. We don't need people like that ruling us. If there's a disagreement with what a branch of government is doing, tell us what it is that you disagree with so we can examine it. Not to say the only thing I want to do is get rid of that guy, but there's a lot of that.
Do you see the relationship between big money and politicians affecting the delivery of health care?
I wish I could give you a good answer, Alan, just have not thought about it. I do know one thing.
But you think about everything.
Bernie Sanders went to my high school.
Mm-hmm.
I met him there at a high school reunion. He's a human being. He's a decent guy. And what he says usually makes sense. I think I would quote him more than me, certainly.
Well, I've, in fact, interviewed him countless hours.
You have the same impression?
Oh, yeah. But I don't think he's a hail fellow well met. I think what he is a serious fellow who has thought a great deal. Here's this senator from Vermont who speaks with a Brooklyn accent. And people there love him. They love their Bernie.
They should. Yeah. He's open. He's honest. He's decent. Listen, Charles Schumer also went to my high school.
You feel the same way about him as you do about Bernie?
Well, he has a different role in the Senate. Mm-hmm. He's now become probably the most important part of the Senate.
Second, after Harry.
At least Clinton.
After Reed, yeah.
He has one of the great quotes of all time. He was on our high school basketball team, and they didn't win one game. And they asked him why. He said, we were small, he said, but we were slow.
He also is the inventor of something called the shoemitch, in which he goes to a well-known sandwich shop and has them make him a shoemitch. I wish I could tell you what the ingredients are, but no matter where they go, he orders up a shoemitch and the staff goes out and gets it for him. John, you have these articles that have been written. You're ready to move. What would it take for this country to adopt your and Dr. Schneerson's plan?
Well, we have tried for 2.5 years to convince companies and even the Gates Foundation to give us money to make what we would call pilot lots of these new vaccines, to make a lot which would pass FDA regulations, test it in a small group of people to show that it does what you'd anticipate, and then give that to companies. We wouldn't sell it, or just give it. Can't get it done.
Why?
Maybe it's me and my associate. Maybe we're not good salespeople. I mean, that's possible.
But if you were asking them, you know, the companies and rest, what is it that they would be saying? What if you put a truth meter on their arm and you could read their minds?
I don't know. I think business people want the bottom line, period. Not interested in anything else ever.
Including the saving of lives?
I don't understand that either, Alan. I really don't understand something. By the way, my associate gave me something to read. You can read it. Look it up on the computer. The guy who founded Macy's was a guy named Nathan Strauss.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And he's written about tuberculosis in 1903. He was a century and a half ahead of his time. And read what he has to say about it.
And what does he say?
He said, first things first.
Which is?
Get this done.
Yeah. A lot of people were dying of TB in those days.
Still are.
Yeah. And this would stop it?
You know, I hate to make predictions, especially about something we've done, but I've had so many mistakes in my life, and we've made so many vaccines, I feel this would work 100% and can be given to infants.
And so it's got to be very frustrating that people are either dying of it or incapacitated with TB. For years, we were sending people up into the mountains, you know.
Magic Mountain.
Yeah, as opposed to really finding.
Let me tell you something even more upsetting to me.
Yeah.
We have published what I'm sure is a safe, effective, cheap vaccine for malaria to be given to infants.
Well, malaria is a huge problem around the world.
Can't get anyone to talk about it.
Why?
It's beyond me.
Is there a competitive methodology for...
This is all new, all original. We work with very senior scientists and cheap. I mean, it's easy to make.
And you have succeeded when it came to the meningitis. So that it's not as if you're a bunch of kooks who haven't done it before. You know what you're doing.
And typhoid.
Yeah.
They're using our vaccine all over the world. You know, the only company that doesn't make a typhoid vaccine the way we told them to is it's a company in the United States.
Really? And since they've started to use your vaccine, the typhoid vaccine, how mitigated has the disease become?
Well, where they've used it, southern China, which had a terrible, and Burma, just went away.
Amazing. Very frustrating indeed. So if you could reorganize the way we did basic research in this country, medical research, if you could try to avoid the kind of political problems that you may be having right now and the competitive problems, what would you do?
You know, I really have not given much thought to it. I look forward to reading the journals that come out with new ideas and new data on biology, on infectious disease and vaccines. I really don't have time for it. I like to listen to music.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't have time for thinking about it. And I leave it to people like Bernie Sanders and you to figure it out because I haven't.
Nevertheless, it seems to me, having been through the mill, you know where the standpipes are. You know where the places that stop good stuff from happening are. And you know, I also know your mind. I know how creative you are and how insightful you are. So you must have some ideas.
Well, the most important thing I think in my life is the senior people that I've been assigned to, my teachers. Teachers, professors are the most important thing. They're the inspiring ones. They're the ones that ask questions that can't be answered. They're the ones that guide you. I think that's the key. The educational staff, the teachers, the professors, high school teachers, the elementary school teachers, that's what's most important. And it looks like we're ignoring them more than we should. I went to elementary school. I was delighted to learn how to read. I was delighted to learn how to count and multiply. And that's because the teachers I had were sensational. And that delight in learning, the delight in having things that you didn't have before intellectually, that's passed on.
John Robbins, your legacy, of course, is we've discussed it here today, and we know what you've done, and it's remarkable. So when you think about all of this, is there a perspective you'd like to leave us with?
I'm not that wise. I wish I was. I would say make room for young minds, even if they don't agree with you, if it's original, if it's enthusiastic, if it's well thought out. Only good things can come of it.
I heard on the BBC this very morning as we speak that there's one guy going around thinking that human beings will be able to live to 1,000 years of age. You think he's right?
Listen, when we were born, you know what the life expectancy was?
What, 40s?
You know what it is now?
80 almost.
If you go to China, you see girls that are 6 feet one. When we went there first years ago, they were all little people. Anything can happen. The potential of our race is yet to be realized.
John Robbins, always wonderful to see you. I'm so glad you spent all of this time and come over to Albany to be with us. I do appreciate it so much, and thank you for your wonderful help. We've been in conversation with infectious disease expert Dr. John Bennett Robbins. I'm Alan Chartok. John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Nice to see you again, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.